Blog Talk Radio.
I'm popular and popping dope. Breakfast at Papa Dough. Dodging all obstacles. Trapping at the stop and go. Boy, you know you lame if you still riding stop and go. Dissect the beat and then I turn into a particle. Pardon dough, I'm hardened dough. You should read the articles. I'm riding high and dodging hoes. You better hope I'm dodging yours. Marta hole, dollar hole. White looking Madonna hole. Dough shake a Bonifera gum and I'm Prada hole. College hole, zone three. Niggas with a lot of gold. Snoop guard the dough. I just love being by the stove. There's some food for thought. A little food for your soul. I'm like a comma. I love being right next to O's.
I had a long day. My nerve bad. Yeah, I'm smoking on loud. I know you heard it. Hit the juice.
If you had a long day and your nerves are bad, then you come to the right place, because you're right here with Foul Territory, listening to another episode live on Blog Talk Radio, hosted by BackSportsPage.com and SidelinesApp.com. Once again, this is Foul Territory with that beautiful intro music provided by 2 Chainz.
2 Chainz!
Produced by the Mixtape King, DJ Drama. His daughter goes to Waldorf school. Carson didn't go to Waldorf school, though. He went to the Friends school. And
yeah, so I was normal.
You were normal. You were pretty normal. You were normal and you were sharing all of your emotions. but we're not in the classroom anymore. Now we're the teachers and school's in session. So, Carson, what have you learned recently that you want to share with all of our beautiful, beautiful listeners about this wonderful sports world of ours?
Something I learned recently. Something I learned recently, as we all know, the World Baseball Classic wrapped up last night, Dominican getting the win over Puerto Rico in San Francisco. One thing that I learned recently was that the Dominican team adopted a pet plantain, the fruit, as a good luck charm to guide them through the trials and tribulations of the World Baseball Classic. Francisco Rodney, the relief pitcher, said that the plantain spoke to him and said that if he kept him close, they would win the entire thing. their win last night, just proof that, you know, the plantain came through.
So I'm thinking one of two things. Either A, the plantain is a good luck charm, or B, the plantain actually predicted this victory, much like that German octopus. And I'm kind of imagining a spin the bottle scenario. Each team on the edge of a table and Fernando Rodney up at 4 a.m. drinking whiskey and just spinning this plantain over and over and on the DR.
That sounds about right.
And, you know, Fernando Rodney and that whole Dominican team played a hell of a WBC, and they have every reason to just celebrate like they did. And I know from firsthand experience that plantains, when prepared by a Dominican woman, or could be man as well, are quite delicious. My friend Lorena Lama, aka The Blade, made some very good fried plantains. The trick is double frying them, Carson. I don't know if you knew that.
Did not know about that, the double frying technique. But like you said, yeah, a well-cooked plantain, Asa, definitely tasty. And no doubt the Dominican team ate a lot of those in preparation for their World Baseball Classic.
They did. You could even get the dried ones and kind of eat them like chips, which would be good for a baseball dugout situation. Well, we're going to get more into talking about the World Baseball Classic, of course, and breaking down a little bit just how dominant the Dominicans were. But before we get into that, we're going to start you off with our listeners' most favorite, most dear, most delighted, most humorous segment. I'm talking about
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. She's got a smile that it seems to me reminds me of childhood memories, where everything was as fresh as a bright blue sky.
All right, Tommy, you're the oldest. I'm counting on you. Come on.
She's got eyes of the bluest sky.
All right, I'm going to get us started this week on Tweet Child of Mine with one of my favorite outputs from the Twittosphere this past week, and it comes from a man that we both know well. His handle is at Dre9889. I'm talking about David Edgar, and this isn't so recent. It's actually 6 days old, but it happened just after the most recent episode. And therefore, I have to share it with you. And it was at me, actually, so I'm flattered by that. And it says, "It's awesome when your new running back's Twitter picture is him riding an elephant. Hashtag beast. Hashtag Falcons. At Steven Jackson. SJ39. Of the Atlanta Falcons." And he actually already changed his picture. Those of you who might be scanning Twitter right now, now it's a picture of him in front of a Falcons backdrop, which we like to see. But I'm sure if you scroll back through there, you can find an awesome one of him riding an elephant.
Wow.
So that, beast on the elephant, beast riding, you know, being ridden. I don't know which one is more beastly, the Jackson himself or the beast below him.
Elephant's unique. Can't knock that.
Yeah, I mean, the average American athlete, especially a guy who, you know, went to college and was an excellent athlete in college and then went straight to the pros and has been dominant. I guess you have a long off season in the pros, but you haven't had a lot of time to kind of go explore the world and, you know, unwind and find yourself. You know, these guys, it's a very grinding lifestyle. And don't get me wrong, they're getting paid lots of money for it. But, you know, it's always good to see these guys getting out in the world and experiencing it a little bit. And Steven Jackson seems like a pretty wise soul to me, at least I can tell on his Twitter musings. What do you got?
I cannot disagree with you on that.
What do you got for us, Carson, on Twitter for Tweet Child of Mine?
So for my tweet child of mine, coming from a buddy of mine named Connie, checking in from Chicago. I played football with a guy in college, and he tweeted, "Fortunate to have been a part of the game when I was. Looks like things will be very different in the future. Hashtag sad." This is in referral to the new crown rule that's been implemented by the NFL that will disallow running backs to lower their head, you know, in the open field to seek contact. Definitely going to be a huge, huge change for the league this year and in upcoming years. Like you said, it's going to be a very drastic change in the way the game looks.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they're just taking swipes out of the fabric of the game wherever they can. And don't get me wrong, brain trauma is a horrible, horrible thing. But I think it's interesting. I don't know. I guess we chose independently, but I feel like our tweets are slightly intertwined just in that Steven Jackson is one of the guys I think of when I think of that move of lowering your head and really just blasting somebody in the secondary. So he's someone who will have to make an adjustment, you know, as someone. And it's hard. He's played, you know, he played the majority of his career under the pre-concussion freakout policies. And the last few years of his career, there have been a lot of changes. And it's one thing to have to make those changes coming from college to the NFL, but it's quite another thing to have been one of the best backs in the league using a certain set of running techniques. And you got your certain style that you've used for, you know, he's a 10-year pro. But, you know, make the changes or get fined, I guess, is Roger Goodell's policy.
And I also understand, ASAP, you know, what is the goal line going to look like now? Do you just run sweeps left and right and see if you can get the corner? Like,
right, right. Well, I think, isn't there something about it being outside the tackle box? Like, this particular rule, like, you can't be called. I don't know the exact language, but I thought I heard that you really, I don't know. It ultimately, it's just going to be confusing, I think, to the fans, to everyone. Because what is the open field? Sometimes the open field happens to be in the middle of the field after a cutback or something. You know, sometimes the open field I don't know, sometimes you're on the edge, but it's a screenplay and you got four blockers around you. So I don't really know how that's going to work. And it's just making it really hard on these refs, independently of all the health discussions, like just thinking about it mechanically. God, the refs have a nightmare job now. They're not deciding what to call. You can blame the refs for individual judgments, but the overall tone and timber, if you will, of the league's policy, it's not set by the refs. They're told what to do. They're told how to call the game, and their jobs are just so difficult, and I'm sure I'll curse them out 90 million times in the coming fall, but still, you gotta feel for them.
Definitely, definitely, definitely true, and, you know, a wrinkle's been thrown in, and, you know, we'll see what things look like in the preseason, and hopefully that'll give them time to sort things out, but, you know, it's such a drastic change, I doubt that things will go as smoothly as planned.
Yeah, no doubt. We're going to talk a little bit more about the NFL later, but we usually like to start with the most topical item, and therefore we're going to get right into March Madness, because as Brandon Beachy tweeted, I guess this is my unofficial second tweet child of mine tweet, it is March Madness Eve, so happy March Madness Eve. We have the first four playing tonight. Those are four playing games. There usually just be one, but now they, you know, why not? Another chance to make some TV money. So not that they're selling many tickets to them. So we have four games tonight. We have LIU Brooklyn, I believe, just fell to James Madison. All sorts of fun stuff going on. But it gets started in earnest tomorrow. The next 2 days are going to be true madness. The first round is always the most fun. And Carson, I believe you do have to work tomorrow, but you mentioned to me that there's a chance your boss might allow some sort of viewing. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, tomorrow's going to be tough having to pretend to work while watching these games. But Friday we have an audit day where we're going through all the files in the office. Just a day of just physical review of files, not too much client contact, not too much, you know, working on other projects we might have. So I think we're going to be able to put the online games on in the big monitor in our conference room just to be able to check the score. I organized our department's second annual March Madness bracket challenge. So definitely a lot on the line.
That sounds like fun. Luckily, you still with us? Hey, Skype, get your stuff together. Carson is in and out right now. But I agree. It is fun to do it with people in the workplace to exert your knowledge of the game a little bit. I have a strange work schedule in that I'm not on the standard Monday through Friday 8-to-5 format. So I'm going to have the joy of being able to watch everything tomorrow. And yes, I'm gloating about that. Yes, I am. Half the games tomorrow and then half on Friday. It is true madness. And if I can get Carson back in here.
Yeah, I'm back.
You're back. Okay, good. Good. That's exciting. And we're in a bracket pool together on Yahoo.com. And so we could talk about that a little bit and see how we measure up, because can you even see people's brackets on the group yet? I don't think you can.
I'm not sure about other folks, but I can go through, you know, my final four with you.
Yeah, let's compare final fours.
You want to? So we'll come out. I think it's a pretty easy ride for them to the final four here in Atlanta.
Is it Louisville?
Yeah, got Louisville, you know, beating Duke in the quarterfinals to make it the semis on the West. I think the West is a pretty weak bracket, all things considered. So I have Wisconsin coming out of Wisconsin, coming out of that bracket, and then we move to the South. You don't even have to say who we got coming out. I got the Hoyas checking in, and then in the East. Look for Indiana, Cody Zeller, Oladipo to carry that team to the Final Four. And then I have Indiana beating Georgetown, making it to the championship, and then Louisville over Wisconsin, and then Louisville winning it over Indiana here in Atlanta in the finals. What about you, Ace? What you got?
Wow. Bold choices. I like that. Unfortunately, I have 2-1 seeds. It's usually more than I like to pick, so sue me. I like also Louisville coming out. I think they're going to make it all the way to the national championship game, although I like them falling to one of my other Final Four teams. I just think they are just so good, and I love Rick Pitino. I'll always pick for Rick Pitino, and Peyton Siva, to me, is one of the real difference makers, and I think point guard play might be the most important thing when it comes down to it. They talk about guard play, and hitting threes is definitely important. They have guys that can do that. Once you have that covered, point guard play is so critical. In the West, I'm so torn. I really am. I really hate all the teams out West. I don't believe in any of them. And I wanted to pick Gonzaga, but, you know, I just can't do it. I don't think I can pick Gonzaga. I just don't feel like they're battle-tested. They have such talent and such depth. But then after that, I just don't know, because you pick Wisconsin. I love Bo Ryan, and I love, you know, the team concept there, but I just don't think they have the firepower. I like Kansas State to make it to the Sweet 16, and I'm tempted to pick Kansas State to beat Gonzaga. You know what? I'm just fucking doing it. So I think they're going to beat Gonzaga. I think they're taking them down, or, you know, who knows? Maybe Gonzaga falls before that. And after that, man, I just don't know. I guess I like, you know what? I'm taking Arizona in the Final Four.
Wow.
I'm doing it.
Wow.
Making a bold choice there. You know? I don't know.
That's a bold move. I mean, you know, and I guess this time of year, March Madness, it is madness. You got to take chances if you want to take the pot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you do. And my third one is going to be Michigan. I just think that talent is going to come together on that team. Again, we talk about guard play. There's a lot of freshmen on that team, and there's a lot of freshmen in important roles in that front court. So it's going to be up to them to really hold it together. And I mean, it's just such a young team overall. But when you can score like they can score, I think you can beat anybody. And they're good enough to make it, you know, to the Sweet 16. I mean, VCU is definitely a challenge. They are a challenge, but, you know, I think Michigan could shoot their way past Kansas. And I was really tempted to take Florida there, but I partly am taking Michigan to create what I think would be an incredible matchup in the semifinals. And that's between Michigan and my Eastern region champion, Miami. And I like Miami actually to win it all. I'm taking Miami to win it all. I think Miami will beat Michigan in that semi, which I think would be an incredible game, and then go on to beat the Louisville Cardinals.
Wow.
Yeah.
Miami's a team a lot of folks have going deep. With the season they had. Like Michigan's a scary team. I think they've slipped up a little bit in the season when they've had the spotlight on them. You know, they had the number one or top spot in the country 2 times, wanting to lose it. But I think, like you said, that talent, if it comes together, they can definitely put together a great run in this tournament.
Yeah, no doubt. And so let's talk about some games in this first round that we're excited for. One of the ones that everybody's talking about, and so we'll just mention briefly, because we're not everybody, but it's still an exciting game, so I'm not going to stay away from it just to be different. Oklahoma State, Oregon, and the teams are interesting, but also the situation, because as everybody knows, everybody who pays any attention to college basketball knows, there is always a 5-12 upset. I think 24 out of the last 26 seasons or something like that. So, you know, it's kind of silly to just consider that a rule. But, you know, there are deeper reasons for that. But Oklahoma State, they're loaded, and they might have one of the best backcourts in the country. That's a pretty good Oregon team, but I just don't see that one happening. What do you think? All right, well, we're getting Carson back on the phone. Skype is being a little female dog on this particular evening. Hey, are you there, sir?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, cool. Anyway, so I was just singing the praises of Oklahoma State versus Oregon. I just don't think Oregon pulls off that upset. What do you think?
I mean, you know, I like Ohio State, and I like the veteran leadership of Kraft.
Oklahoma.
I'm not too set on the Oregon team this year. I think the Big Ten is a very talented conference, and they should have, you know, a lot of representatives late in the tournament.
That was Oklahoma State, but
oh, excuse me. Okay,
don't worry about it. Ohio State should cruise to a first round victory over Iowa.
Okay, yeah, no, they didn't have the bracket up. Sorry. Yeah, no. I definitely have Oklahoma State in that game as well. And I think they might have a pretty easy route, at least to the Sweet 16. I have them losing to Louisville. But you never know. It's just that the 12-5 matchup is like clockwork. At least one has to be an upset. Do you have a 12-5 upset as of now?
Yes, I do. And I was not going to pick Wisconsin to lose. As good as the deep ball shooter is on Mississippi, and I'm going to pick VCU to go out in the first round. So I landed on California over UNLV, and I confess that I don't have a ton of knowledge about those two teams, but that one just seemed like the most logical.
Yeah, no, I'm in the same boat. I picked the same game. I had the same thought process with VCU. I thought about picking them losing the first round, but this was a tournament experience that Shaka Smart has had in the whole program. They just seem to flourish when March comes around. I couldn't do that.
Yeah, no, it's cool to have these mid-majors that are consistently really good, because Butler is a team who I have losing to Miami, but they've been to the finals the last two of the last 3 years or the last 2 years. And, you know, that's huge. It doesn't matter who the particular players on this team are. Clearly their coach and their system and, you know, some of the carryover on players is enough to make them a really, really, you know, you should consider them a real threat to make a run to the Final Four. I don't think anyone is going to take them lightly this season, this madness. Have you gotten any sense from your fellow Atlantans what their finals picks might be? Because to win a pool, that's really the key, is to get the champion right.
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, based on just my office, I mean, I've seen a lot of Louisville. I've seen some Indiana, Kansas. But usually, sort of those Indiana and Louisville have had a sharp representation. ACU, along with my father, picked Miami to win it all.
Nice.
Interesting choices. So those are sort of the main teams that I've seen. What about yourself on the West Coast?
Louisville is what I've been seeing on the internet, at least. I think a lot of people pick Kansas just because they feel like a safe pick. Like people pick Kansas. I've been so disappointed with people I talk to. You know, me and Sam, who Sam is a guy we've had on the show before to talk about NBA free agency, Sam Meyerkopf, who Carson and I both know well. You know, me and him were giving my roommate absolute hell last night for just being the least ballsy picker of all time. I mean, there's an option on our Yahoo bracket to autofill based on the top seeds. It looked like he did that except for like two changes. And if you're doing that, I mean, what's the point, right? Have some stones, pick some upsets, pick some, you know, lower seeds. Last year was the year that all four number one seeds made it. So you're really going to pick that this year? You pick twice in a row? You fool! I think Indiana's popular pick. And I have a hard time against them, but I actually have them going on to NC State.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I mean, just trying to see what other that might be available.
Harvard.
Yeah. Temple beating NC State.
No. I have NC State beating Indiana.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Syracuse.
Wow.
I have NC State in my Elite Eight.
Okay. Well, there we are. If NC State makes that run, I'll tell you, my bracket's completely busted. and I think a lot of folks would be. I think you'd be sitting pretty.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to pick against Indiana, but that is honestly part of the reason that I picked that. And when it comes to pools, there's more of a general strategy that, you know, sometimes involves picking favorites to lose early rather than trying to get every single game right. And so I subscribe to that in large part. And Indiana, they have so much talent, but I've just watching them this year, I've gotten to see them a fair amount of times, and they just don't always have that mental toughness at the end of the game. And that worries me a little bit. They definitely have the talent. And, you know, I would not be surprised to see them make the Final Four. But because I wanted Miami to win it all, I was like, you know what? They're going to do that. It would certainly help if Indiana went down early. So, you know, who knows? Maybe the guy who just flipped the coin every time will do better than me.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of the tournament. It seems like the folks that watch the least amount of basketball do the best in these brackets. And I think that's the, you know, the allure of this time of year and why we as, sports fans.
Yeah. You know what I think would be an awesome game? Is
what was that?
Louisville versus Michigan State.
Wow. Yeah, definitely.
That would be a really fun game. Too.
I mean, yeah, just two absolute legends for coaches going head-to-head and, you know, always underlying about for supremacy in the college field. So that would definitely be a good matchup to watch.
Yeah, and isn't March Madness so much? I mean, occasionally a player will come along and carry his team, but I think coaching is – so much more important in this competition than in almost any other, well, it's not professional sports, but in any other, just sports competition that's so in the public eye in this country. I mean, a good coach, he can do so much. Strategically, you have to be constantly adjusting and counter-adjusting because you're playing a totally new opponent every other day or every week. And in addition to that, you have to provide just a wealth of emotional support because it's, you know, it takes so much guts to make a run all the way to the Final Four and or to win it all. So, a game like that, like you were saying, I totally agree. I think the coaching comes out and really would be on display in that contest.
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, Asa, buddies of these teams have look at the chain. It's just so weird, you know, seeing them in that aspect to, you know, put together a streak to win whatever those four games that you need to win in a row. Was it four or five?
Five, I think. Yeah, first round, second round, Sweet 16, or is it six? One, two, five, there we go.
Five. Yeah, so as I was saying, it's so crazy that, you know, it's tough enough to do in the regular season, let alone for the championship. And obviously that's just an outstanding quality that teams have to be able to put that all together. But, hopefully, you know, Georgetown and my other Final Four teams are getting ready to do just that.
Georgetown, huh? Every
Let's
year, man,
it.
You got that soft spot for them.
I feel like this year is the year, and if you haven't, all listeners out there, watched a young man by the name of Otto Porter Jr. play basketball. Watch him. I really think he can be special, not only in the college ranks but in the pros. He just does everything so well. I feel like he's sort of like a Tayshaun Prince, but like a lot better.
Yeah,
he's long.
I too am excited to see him in the NBA.
Yeah. I mean, Georgetown system, I love to death, but it doesn't really play to the offensive strengths of a lot of guys. But I think him and the L system would just, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, and he's like a playmaker, too. He's got that incredible passing ability in addition to all his shot-making skills.
Yeah, definitely. He's just all around contributor.
Is he going to be coming to the draft this year, you think?
I think so. I've seen some mocks that have him, you know, as a 10th rated prospect coming out. I think it'd be tough for him not to. And just, you know, he's only a sophomore and he's done some great things. You know, consensus Big East player of the year this year. So I think he's gone, but it'd be good for him to make a deep run. In his last year at Georgetown.
Yeah, no doubt. Speaking of deep runs, we're going to run deep into the NFL offseason. We're changing tones on you people, ladies and gentlemen. The tournament will be fun. We'll be getting back to that in coming weeks because we'll be at a perfect time getting like an update of the first few rounds next week and then, you know, the later rounds. And then after that, we'll have a championship preview and all that good stuff. But right now, we're getting to the National Football League. And it starts with the bookends. I'm talking about the edge players. Everybody knows that the NFL is a passing league now. And in order to defend the pass, the first thing that comes to mind is, oh, we have to defend the receivers. Wrong! You have to put the quarterback on his ass. That's the only way to beat a good passing team. It's the only way to beat Tom Brady. It's the only way to beat Peyton Manning. It's the only way to rattle Aaron Rodgers. It's what you have to do if you want to defend these top passing attacks. And therefore, these players are in high demand. I'm talking about defensive ends as well as outside linebackers. Some of these guys are hybrids. Some of these guys could play one or the other, whether it's 4-3 or 3-4. But a lot of teams also need these players. So let's start with the hottest name on the block. I'm talking about the king himself, Elvis Dumervil.
Dumervil.
Carson, what the hell is going on with Elvis right now?
Elvis, you know, has left the building, and the building being Denver. There's a big, big snafu with him and his now ex-agent between a miscommunication between the Denver front office and Elvis's representatives. In a deal that needed to be made by a certain time that didn't happen when both sides actually agreed upon an agreement, but that didn't happen. Denver apparently reached out to Elvis after he'd become a free agent, and the deal that they sort of offered him, you know, as a free agent wasn't his liking. So now he's planning on visiting a number of NFL teams in the next 48 hours that could definitely use his assistance.
Yeah, so who do you think are going to be the teams clamoring to get him? And by that, I mean who has the need, but who also has the cap space.
So there's a number of teams that they mentioned that he may be interested in meeting with. There hasn't been sort of an official, you know, list named so far. But a team like the Colts, you know, who lost Dwight Freeney to free agency, who ended up cutting him to create space on the cap, an aging guy who had been in this one team for so long. If you look at a team like the Ravens, who have done so much, you know, Ed Reed walk, Kruger walk, Ellaby walk, a lot of guys on their defense, you know, no longer there. They could definitely use a guy like Elvis Dumervil. And then just to be biased, you can look at us as the Falcons. You know, we let go of John Abraham, got rid of Duncan Robinson, some other guys to make cap space. You know, we did sign Steven Jackson, but I still think we have, you know, room to make one more big move. And I think that Elvis Jimmer would help us immensely, like you said, not only you know, on the defensive line, but stopping the pass in the pass happy league.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And taking things to the dome or to the new stadium that will be built soon, now that the city has quaked under the pressure, not only do they need a big signing, and as you say, we have room for one more big signing, and as great as it is to get Steven Jackson, we really need to shore up the defensive side of the ball. We need some depth, especially on that defensive line. When the defensive line has performed well, which really hasn't been that often over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, that's really been the team's Achilles heel, I believe. When they have performed well for stretches, it's because they had a very good rotation. They had 7 players that could come in and out, that could provide fresh bodies to throw at the offensive line, you know, that could get different guys giving different linemen looks, shifting around, some guys inside, some guys that could play out. And as great as it is to try to get a top-flight player on the D-line, the reality is you're going to have to be using rotations, even if you have very good players. And so I think hopefully through the draft we'll address that. But I would also like to see us address that through some, you know, maybe some smaller name free agent signing, but more copious ones to shore up that line. Maybe bring in a veteran guy like Richard Seymour and, you know, let him play a little bit and teach some of these young guys in the middle of that D-line.
Yeah, definitely. And I think with the draft, too, you know, we just got awarded 4 compensatory picks from the NFL as a result of free agent signings. That we can use, and I think Asa, you know, when I first saw that, you know, we were awarded these picks, not very high picks, but I think that undrafted it could come in handy for us to make a move, you know, either in the first or second round, for a guy that can really help shore up some issues on our defense.
Yeah, no doubt. And let's talk about another guy who's not as big of a name as Doomerville, but who's been very productive, and I'm talking about Sean Phillips, who's been one of those combo edge players in the Chargers system. He's been a 3-4 for years now. And Sean Phillips is good, not great. He was playing across from Sean Merriman for a number of years, which maybe that helps your stats. But he's been consistent. He had, aside from a bad year in 2011 when he battled to stay healthy, he's had 7 or more sacks in 8 consecutive years and gone over 10 a couple times. So he's a guy who can get at the quarterback. He's 31 years old, which is not old, not young. He's getting up there. But on a 2-year deal, on a lower risk deal, and he'll probably command less money than Doomerville, he could be a nice addition too to a 3-4.
No, yeah, 100%. And like you said, Asa, you know, a lot of these veteran guys definitely. Or any team that needs an edge rusher for that fact, if they can come in, use guys learning, and have a couple productive seasons, you know, that's definitely a value in that.
Yeah, for sure. So let's go through a little more of these edge rushers types, and I want to ask you one question, and I'm referring to 3 that are getting up there in age who are. At one point, it wasn't that long ago, but they were considered at the top, the cream of the crop of this position. And these 3 guys are Dwight Freeney, your boy, James Harris, time Steeler, and OCU Mignogna, the same resume as those 2 guys. You know, for a couple of years stretch there was everything. Out of these 3, who do you like the best? To have a good resurgence season this year, and who would you like to see your team target, or who would you target if you were a GM?
You know, I would say OCM and Ure, and I think that you know, he's younger than the other 2 guys that you mentioned, and he, like you said, he has had some degree of success in the past. And when I think OCM and Ure, what his problem was his attitude and the fact that. You know, while he was injured and he was having contract disputes, you know, he, you know, sort of expected the Giants, I feel like, to sort of miss him and need him in his absence, and, you know, and thus making him more valuable, you know, of an asset for him to have. But as we saw this past season, you know, the Giants are very capable with the guys they have up front to replace him and have guys that can get after the quarterback and, you know, very effective in the pass rush. They're an absolute nightmare for offensive linemen. So I think that, you know, he has the potential to play well if he's given the right opportunity and he's sort of getting, you know, into the right mindset that he's there to contribute and help. Whereas I feel like a lot of things happened off the field in New York that sort of contributed to him, you know, not ending up with the Giants and having to look for work in the offseason.
I totally agree with that sentiment. And like you said, he's only 31 years old. He's not at the same career point as those other two guys who I mentioned. And this guy not only was one of the forces on that D-line, he was pretty much the ringleader of that D-line during the Giants Super Bowl run. And, you know, a guy who had 10 forced fumbles back in 2010. So if he can get on a team where he feels real motivated, where, you know, he likes his new teammates. And it sounds like we're coddling this guy, and we are to a degree. You know, in reality, he should nut up a little bit. But the fact is, he's won a ring, he's gotten paid, and it makes sense that it takes a little more to like his career. If he could get on a team that he really felt like was going places and could rediscover that spark, who knows? Maybe he could get back to the 13 sack years that he had as part of that fearsome foursome up front for the dirty, dirty New Jersey Giants.
Yeah, I like that name. I like that name.
Thank you. Thank you. So we dealt with some defensive players, but as much as I would like to get to a skill position, I'm going to honor the great Carson Phillips spots by going over to the offensive line.
Yes, sir.
Because it's a crucial, crucial part of your football team. They're not the guys that are always acknowledged, although they're always acknowledged by quarterbacks and running backs. And it's very difficult to evaluate them. If you don't know football that well, it's very tough to see which lineman is laying the right block on which play, even though, you know, they're all kind of working in tandem. It's a very hard thing to analyze, but that's why we got Carson here. And in my eyes, which is really in the eyes of Grantland's Bill Barnwell, give him that shout out, the three best linemen still available after Jake Long was locked up are Lance Lewis, Andre Smith, and Sebastian Vollmer of the formerly of the Patriots. Is there one of those three guys that sticks out to you as someone who a team could look at to fortify their men up front?
You know, me personally, I think that Andre Smith would be a guy that could be an asset to a team. A guy who was highly, you know, touted coming out of Alabama, had some issues, you know, in the combine and the workouts, and then had, you know, battled some injuries in his first couple of years. And I felt like he'd become a very solid starter on a rapidly improving Cincinnati offense. So I think he's the guy that can contribute to your team. I think he'd be a solid starter. He's not going to blow you away. I think that, you know, his potential or his expectations, he definitely didn't live up to, and he might not be the guy that, you know, folks anticipate him to be. But you look at a guy like Sebastian Vollmer, I think that his story is pretty unique in the fact that he sort of came out of nowhere. He was a backup for a while. You know, I believe he's out of Houston. University of Houston, didn't play too much in college. He's actually German, you know, born in Germany and played football for a little bit here in the United States, but became a star for the Patriots sort of out of the blue. I'm always sort of hesitant to pick or at least, you know, pay guys copious amounts of money that sort of have that story, especially with the Patriots. As we all know that Bill Belichick can be very specific in the type of guy he chooses, and sometimes they end up being products of the system. So I think Andre Smith out of that group probably the best fit for most teams.
Okay. And is he a guy who can play the left side or the blind side of a quarterback?
I would probably stick him at right tackle.
Okay.
I think he's just – I mean, just in terms of his athleticism, from what I've seen of him, wouldn't really, count on him to protect the asset you have in your quarterback.
Good to know. Well, let's head from the trenches out to the far grassy reaches of the backfield. And I'm talking about the defensive backfield, because there are some talented and some questionable and some just downright ancient cornerbacks available. A lot of big names, though. A lot of guys that I remember from my Madden days. Gentlemen, I would sign on my franchise roster and cut the next year because the guy I drafted was better. And some of these names that are jumping out, we'll get to some of the more talented guys coming off injuries in a minute. But I'm talking about Quentin Jammer. Always remember him. Terrence Newman, longtime Cowboy. And Antoine Winfield, who's been up in Minnesota with the Vikings for a hot minute. So do those three guys have anything left in the tank? Do you think they would have to kind of move down into the slot, or, you know, where's their place on a team?
So for Quentin Jammer, I think that he would probably be the best fit in a team that utilizes the Tampa 2 or a cover 2 defense, a team that plays a lot of cover 2. Because, I mean, Quentin Jammer, he's a big guy. He's a big corner. Not too keen on interceptions. That's not saying he's a bad corner. I think he does a good job in coverage. But, you know, as his last name states, he's a jammer. He plays on the line a lot, jams receivers. And I think he probably fit best in the cover 2 system. If you don't ask him to cover guys one-on-one, way down the field, across the field, but to play that flat, check guys off the line, and then sort of help out and run the fence. So that's where I see him. Terrence Newman, a guy that was just sort of at the top of his game for a long time in Dallas, first-round pick out of Kansas State. Asa, he might be a guy that I think you might have to put him in special packages. I think his sort of upside isn't that great. We signed a guy like Asante Samuel this past season, in the offseason, an older guy who helped us out, I think, immensely on the defensive side of the ball. But I think his upside isn't as great as that. But you might be able to get some use out of him in certain situations.
Okay. That was very in-depth on three veterans of this league. So what about a couple guys coming off of injury? And one guy is very well-known, and that guy is Nnamdi Asamoah. That's my best attempt. And the other guy is less well-known, but dear in the hearts of the fellows you and I consider old friends, and I'm talking about Brent Grimes. And my first question is, why the hell haven't the Falcons locked up Brent Grimes yet?
I'm not too sure about, the process in terms of contract negotiation and where we are right now in those talks. And I got to think that, it's going to come down to, money obviously is going to be a major factor in the fact that he's coming off the injury. I think that the Falcons front office will try to I feel like we reverse the clock 1 year, and he was
Oh, you're breaking up, Paul.
Well,
having a little trouble hearing Carson right now. We're going to get right back to that cornerback discussion in a second if we can get him back on. Carson, are you there? All right. Well, that's okay. We will roll right along and get him back when we can. We have some other ancient guys, D'Angelo Hall and Sheldon Brown. Sheldon Brown probably most famous for that vicious deep-cleating hit that he laid on Reggie Bush once upon a time when Bush played for the Saints down in New Orleans. And D'Angelo Hall, a much maligned corner with a ton of career interceptions, but I can tell you from watching him week in and week out, many of those interceptions came on plays where the quarterback underthrew the ball after he had been burned or overthrew the ball after he had been made moves on and kind of picked up some interceptions that way. He's one of the best talkers in the league, so I'll give him that. But a guy who I would stay away from pretty much at all costs were someone crazy enough to make me an NL or an NFL general manager. Carson, are you there? Still having trouble getting the man on. All right, well, we'll get him on when we can. We're going to continue to go through the NFL for a little bit right now and then get to some baseball because we told you we teased the WBC right at the top of the show, and so we'll get to that a little bit later. Carson, are you there, my friend?
I'm back.
He's back.
Just popping in and out.
Just popping in and out. Well, I think we might be set on defensive players there. Linebackers, middle linebacker just aren't as exciting with what we've got going on in this offseason. I'll be honest. Tell them how you really feel.
Got to do it.
The skill positions are a little underwhelming, but there's some very interesting candidates, some guys that could help out your team. And running back is a funny position now. There are very few running backs who get 80% or more of a team's carries. And, you know, very, very few guys. A small handful of guys. Even Arian Foster, with his health issues and with them trying to keep him fresh, doesn't even get as many as he should. So usually teams are trying to patch together a backfield of backs who can complement each other and who can excel in different situations. And there's some interesting candidates to complement backfields that are available now. And some of the top names that jump out, Ahmad Bradshaw, Michael Turner, Cedric Benson at this point, I don't know if I would touch that. Peyton Hillis, former Madden cover honoree.
Crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the cabinet is a little bare, but which of these guys do you think has a chance, let's say, to make a fantasy impact next year?
I mean, I'd say just Ahmad Bradshaw. I think he was another guy who just sort of got in the doghouse with, you know, Tom Coughlin and the Giants, you know, got his carries limited. And, you know, really, you know, with the emergence of Wilson towards the end of the season, they sort of saw his sort of role on the team, you know, wasn't there anymore. So, you know, I like him. He always, you know, was a physical back, run hard, had decent speed. Whereas Peyton Hillis, there's some issues about his durability or his, you know, his will to play the football game. Never really saw him as a really big threat. And then, like the other guys, Cedric Benson, Michael Turner, just sort of on the back end of their careers, and it's kind of tough to sort of, you know, have those guys on a team at the running back position when they're, you know, they're an influx of young guys that are going to come into this league this year and be able to contribute off the bat.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. It's a questionable group. And even my boy, LaRod Stevens Howling, I don't think is going to get paid too heftily. Although I'm rooting for you, LaRod. Quarterback. Yeah. Is a mess. So we're not even going to talk about that because you don't want to touch that. Receivers, a lot of really borderline players. I was just not shocked at all when I read a couple weeks ago, I don't think we even mentioned this in past episodes because it didn't seem worthy, but the Jaguars cutting Laurent Robinson after signing him last year to a massive deal for like 5 years, $30 million or something. And it just shows what an inept franchise they are. Although I think LaRont has made something to contribute. I don't know. There's Darius Hayward Bay is available if you want to touch that. There's the giant Ramses Barden, who got his moment in the sun for a little bit last year with the Giants, but clearly they have enough depth at wide receiver that they don't need him. There's Julian Edelman, who could be kind of a sexy pickup if you need a slot guy. He's a poor man's Wes Welker, and that's a pretty obvious comparison, but I'm going with it. You know, there's old Titus Young, old Wacko Titus. You want to get involved with that mess. Got any love for any of these guys, Carson?
You know, in the way that you describe them, it's pretty pretty obvious that it's not the best group. Maybe Jimmy Elements, because he can contribute on special teams as well. I know he's asked to do a lot. We know with the Pages organization. Titus Young, like said, a talented guy, but definitely in that case. And then Darius Hayward Bay possibly, in the right situation, but definitely not the best batch of receivers to choose from as of now.
Yeah, I have to agree. And the good news, though, is that the draft is only about a month away, so we can forget about free agency. In the next couple weeks, I'm sure any of these guys who are considered even complimentary players will get snapped up eventually, and we'll start getting really focused on the draft, which is always exciting and requires months of endless and fruitless speculation, and we love it. Try and get some draft prospects on here. We've got some contacts in the college football world, and we're gonna chase them down and see if we can't get maybe a certain young wide receiver out of South Carolina on the show.
That would be awesome, and definitely be looking for him on draft day to see where he ends up. Where he takes his career and what team will help come next fall.
Yeah, and I also heard that the Holiday Inn in Waterville, Maine was overrun with NFL scouts on the Colby Pro Day, so maybe we can get some of those prospects to come on the phone, too.
The thing is, the draft is, what, April 26th? Mm-hmm. I think Colby's Pro Day is scheduled for July, so good luck with that.
So why do they have a Pro Day?
No, I was kidding.
A pro day. It's such a funny concept in a way. And it makes sense, though, that you would do these drills with people you know, at least if you want to excel at them and look good. Well, let's give the people a brief musical interlude. How's about them apples?
Sounds beautiful.
Do you know what region of the bracket UGA is in?
Well, what?
Do you know what region of the bracket UGA is in?
They're in the Athens region.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's extra time to study for finals.
Shooting natty bows into trash cans.
There it is.
Not a natty bow. That's Baltimore beer. I don't know why I said that. Shooting I don't know. What do they drink? Peavers.
Red Dog.
Let's talk a little bit after this delightful verse wraps itself up nicely and fades itself out about the World Baseball Classic. And it's over. The Dominican won. They beat Puerto Rico in the final. And I don't know. A lot of people are disparaging it because it's not very popular in this country. And, you know, part of that is tied up in embarrassment at the United States not making it to the final round. Part of that is March Madness starting. And I don't know. I thought it was a success. And I thought it was even more just successful than in past years. And it makes sense. And anything is going to take a little bit of time to build momentum when you start it from nothing and it doesn't even have much lead up. You know, I'm excited for it. I'm glad that a team from our hemisphere finally won. I love that Dominican team. I really do. Honestly, on paper, I think they were as good as the USA and clearly way better on the field. So I really enjoyed it. And while people are disparaging it here, the interesting thing, Carson, is everywhere else in the world, viewership was up, attendance at the games was up. So I think it's MLB's, you know, striving to promote the game globally that's more important than its popularity here almost.
Yeah, Ace, that's a very interesting point you made. And definitely, I mean, they showed cutaways to, you know, old San Juan during the game and the Puerto Ricans, you know, very excited to see their team. And, you know, if you look at just the demographics of the game that was played in San Francisco in relation to the game that was played in Miami when the two teams met, I mean, that was the fullest I've seen in Miami Stadium, you know, yet. Those two teams got together with the big Latino population down in South Florida. So, like you said, Aza, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, it's great to hear that it's picked up, especially, like I said, a couple of weeks ago, now that you know, baseball is not an Olympic sport. This can sort of fill that gap.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And it's every 3 years, so it'll be more often than the Olympics anyway, I think. And you know, baseball might make it back a couple of years because I think it's kind of on the bubble. But this is definitely much more fun than that. And you know, the United States team disappointed. They did. And I don't know. I don't think people should make excuses for this team. It's easy for everybody to point to, oh, well, the Dominican guys have been playing in the Winter League and the U.S. guys have been on vacation. You know, well, if you're taking this competition seriously, you would at least be in shape enough to play this series. And, you know, not that any of them looked like they were, you know, had been stuffing their face with donuts, but R.A. Dickey readily admitted that he only had thrown, I think, 2 days during the offseason before he came to the practice for the WBC. So, you know, I don't think the U.S. has any excuses here. They just simply have to perform better. And I think it's going to take what I'm picturing in my mind is kind of a situation like 7 or 8 years ago where the U.S. Lost they got bronze in the Olympics or the World Championships, and that whole young core of LeBron and Wade and all those guys decided, hey, we're going to make USA basketball back into what it was. I think it's going to take something like that and a younger crop, maybe Trout and Harper lead the charge, you know, of guys saying, look, we want to commit to this because we want to win one for America.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, like you said, Asa, it was definitely a big source of pride for the Dominicans to get out there and get that win with that roster littered with talent. And that's a good point. I think that, you know, if guys really do dedicate themselves and you know, want to play in the tournament, that we could put together a great team. And just the parity of the tournament, I think, itself is just awesome. You know, not really knowing what the outcomes will be, these baseball-rich nations, you know, losing games to countries that baseball is growing and emerging. So it would definitely be awesome to see the United States back, you know, as a powerhouse. And, you know, like you said, you know, it's been three of these tournaments and we haven't won yet. So I think a realization is in order.
Yeah, no doubt. And let's give the winners their due. And not only the winners, but the runners-up Puerto Rico played a hell of a tournament after having their backs against the wall. It looked like Italy was going to make it through. Italy had a lead on them and just coughed it up. And, you know, it was a very predictable result as the Italian team kind of just lost a hold on their baseball fundamentals and the Puerto Ricans just pure skill just showed. And there were some interesting things that I observed in that Bob Costas especially talked about last night on the broadcast. And as much as I loved John Smoltz being in the earlier rounds, Bob Costas' voice does lend a certain gravitas to a finale. And he was talking about how the umpires were calling it really loose and using a big strike zone, which I thought actually improved the game. And that's probably because I'm a National League guy. But it was very low scoring. There were a few eruptions of runs. But for the most part, especially in the later rounds as the competition improved, it was many low-scoring games. The Dominican team shut teams out. I don't know. They went 8-0. I feel like they must have had shutouts in half their games. And Puerto Rico made it to the semifinals, even though through the first two rounds they had scored the fewest runs of any team advancing. So that was pretty cool. And, you know, we're talking about the U.S. team, but they were still pretty loaded. I mean, they had all-stars across the board. And David Wright did get hurt, but guys like Joe Mauer, Jimmy Rollins, Brandon Phillips, all Royden Braun, I mean, Eric Hosmer, although that doesn't excite a lot of tingling in my toes. But Giancarlo Stanton, man, he did nothing the whole tournament. And they just got outplayed.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing I wanted to talk to you about, Ace, you know, in the game last night, the Dominican team, their fielding and their hitting was just so stacked and so first rate. What were your thoughts on the Dominican pitching staff when you look and you have all these, you know, outstanding all-star infielders, outfielders, guys that can swing the bat, play defense. But then when you look on the mound, you know, guys that didn't have that much experience, especially not in the major leagues, do you see, you know, a reason why that might be?
Well, I'm really glad you asked me that. That was led right into something I was thinking of talking about. And, you know, for one thing, I think especially when it comes to pitching, while this is not, you know, taking anything away from the Dominican, having pitched in the Winter League really helps for starters because you've gotten a feel for your different pitches. If you're just coming out and hurling and it's early on in your lead up to the season, you're not going to have the feel on a changeup, you know, or the real feel of when to take something off a slider necessarily. Probably Greg Maddux could wake up, you know, and throw a changeup right out of bed in the morning, but most guys can't. But the guy that I was most impressed with was a guy who's in the Twins organization, Samuel Dunno. And everybody saw him because he pitched most of the important games for the Dominican. 13 innings in all, came away with two of the wins in three starts, had a .69 ERA, 17 strikeouts in those 13 innings to only five walks. I mean, the dude was electric. And you saw it. I mean, he has a fastball, and they talked about this in the broadcast booth a lot. Johnny Smoltz was having fun talking about it. The catcher would just set up in the center of the plate. The catcher never went to the corner. He never was looking for a certain spot on the inner half and was sliding over. He was just sitting in the middle and letting that fastball do its work because apparently, according to Joe Mauer, who's caught it in the Twins organization, it's like a fast knuckleball on speed or something. I mean, it is a wild, wild pitch, and he doesn't have a ton of control, and so why not just start it in the middle and let it do what it does? And in addition to that, he showed incredible command of a curveball, not a big breaking curve, only a kind of a small break, but great arm action and just enough late break to miss a ton of bats, as evidenced by his 17 strikeouts. So he was really exceptional. And then that bullpen, which they're a little more known quantities, most of them. Fernando Rodney, like you mentioned, is the ringleader. Pedro Strop kind of came out of nowhere, had a really good season last year as part of that dominant Baltimore bullpen, but he's a guy who I really like going forward. And Santiago Casilla, a guy who closed for the Giants for a while, along with longtime major leaguer Octavio Dotel, who, if I'm not mistaken, holds the record for most major league ball clubs played for.
He might.
He's been on.
That does sound pretty pretty familiar.
Yeah, I mean, I also love that first name, Octavio.
Octavio.
Octavio. And the pitching was great. And Edinson Volquez is the biggest name. Wandy Rodriguez also pitched 9 innings. I didn't see Wandy pitch at all, but Edinson's pretty solid. He's on the Padres now out there in San Diego. But really it was that bullpen, and the bullpen matters a lot in the WBC because of those pitch limits, which aren't quite as important in the later games because it's all the way up to 90. But in the first few rounds, when it's in the 50s or the 60s, that definitely taxes your bullpen. But it's not that many games overall, so you can let these guys throw. But let's just observe and just appreciate and lionize this Dominican batting order and their offensive players. Because let's also emphasize, they don't have their best players either. You could say Americans are missing all these guys. So are the Dominicans. I mean, a little dude by the name of Albert Pujols is not playing for them. Okay, they're missing possibly the best Dominican player of all time, one of the best MLB players of all time. I'll just freaking say it. And so without him, their lineup is still so jacked. Their infield is amazing. At first base is probably the least exciting guy in the infield, and he's still one of the best first basemen in all of baseball. I'm talking about Edwin Encarnacion, who mashed 43 taters for the Toronto Blue Jays, although I don't think they have mashed potatoes up in Canada because that's a little too American for them.
Yeah.
But he's a beast at first. Then Robbie Cano, who hit 469 and took home the MVP of the whole league, is at second base. Jose Reyes at short, Hanley at third, and Carlos Santana at catcher. I mean, that's an infield. That could be an all-star infield, right?
Yo, yeah, 100%. And, and you also mentioned, you mentioned Albert Pujols. Also, Joey Bats. Jose Bautista also, you know, not playing this year. And imagine what he would add to that already ridiculous lineup offensively. If you have him batting third or cleanup, behind Jose Reyes and Eric Ibar. Definitely some things that you definitely want to look at.
Yeah, they're so loaded. And it was kind of cool that Miguel Tejada was like the human victory cigar, because he's one of the Dominicans', you know, really biggest folk heroes, I think, in terms of baseball. And just the timing of it, just because he was, he's not that long ago, but there still is only one Dominican player in the Hall of Fame. So while they have been in baseball for a while, there hasn't been a whole generation to have retired.
Do you know who the one is?
It's Juan Marichal of the San Francisco. And
Okay. No, cause I heard them mention that a couple of times. I was trying to figure out who it was, but I mean, like you said, it's going to be an influx pretty soon.
Yeah, exactly. And they called Juan Marichal the Dominican dandy, which now, back then you said, oh, the Dominican dandy, and you knew who that was. Now you say that, it's like, well, which Dominican dandy? And I heard some other crazy stat that this is totally insane. Okay, first of all, I'm going to go to Wikipedia.org. Give me a second, because I got to lead up to this. I'm going to look up the Dominican Republic.
I got you.
Dominican Republic. And I just want to see how many people live in their country. There's 9.5 million people in the Dominican Republic, okay? There's like 350 million people in America. One quarter of all minor league players are Dominican.
Jeez.
Isn't that insane? Across
that is crazy.
I think John Smoltz dropped that one, so I hope he wasn't making it up and laying me out to dry here. But, I mean, that just blew me away when I heard that.
That's unreal. That's unreal. Like such a small country has produced that many players. And, I mean, I feel like the trend is going to continue. Things will get more regulated in terms of how teams can approach players down in DR. But, I definitely see that trend increasing over the next couple of years.
Yeah, no doubt. And they are just, I don't know. I mean, that team is only going to get better. There's so, like, Jerks and Profar. Or no, he's Netherlands. But I'm really excited for the Netherlands too, and for those European teams. I mean, Spain wasn't great, but I didn't even know they were in it when it started. I was pretty happy for them. What the heck? What else should we talk about? The Puerto Ricans, their offense is just a little disappointing. I mean, it's not totally loaded. Carlos Beltran's obviously a very good hitter, even though he's on the tail end of his career. Yadi is very good. But just not the same bump as the Dominican.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you know, I think they also had some issues with some pitchers that weren't as experienced, but they definitely, you know, performed, you know, remarkably, you know, when given the opportunity. You know, I think they did a lot with their pitching staff, with not a lot of guys that had a lot of quality MLB talent. But yeah, the bats were definitely lacking for the Puerto Ricans.
Puerto Ricanos, and yet they
Puerto made Rican, all Boricua.
And if it's not, I was hearing this today, but if the Dominicans' run is not convincing, I don't know what it is. They went 8-0, they won every single game, and the team that they beat in the finals, Puerto Rico, they had already beaten twice before that. So it's
crazy.
Yeah, when you're winning double elimination, there's no mistakes about it. And, you know, they're going to be the team to beat now. Japan, I'm not really sure why they won it those 2 years, if their style gave them some sort of edge because people weren't really accustomed to it or something. But, you know, their run seems to be at an end. And the Caribbean is rising.
They also made mention before in, you know, in the preliminary rounds that in terms of selecting players that – Japanese wanted to make a point of playing this tournament. I'm not sure if it was designed that way or if the big leaguers just chose not to play, but wanted to play this tournament, you know, with the homegrown guys, the guys who play in the Japanese league, you know, as compared to having a bunch of MLB guys come over. So I'm not sure how that worked out in terms of if they wanted it to happen or not, but I think to look at, you know, they missed some guys that could have helped them. Some big leaguers.
Yeah, I did hear that too. You're completely right. And there's also just some guys that, you know, are either retired or over the hill. Hideki Matsui's no longer there. He was like the best hitter of all time. He was the Babe Ruth of Japan. And you know, obviously Ichiro didn't play, like you said, by design. But yeah, you know, they still had a really good team and they still made it all the way to the quarterfinals, but couldn't make it past the Caribbean. So let's talk about Major League Baseball, because that was, as fun as it was, just an exhibition series, and the real serious business starts up here in just about 2 weeks. Wow, it's so soon. I'm so excited. Fantasy drafts are happening. I got one this weekend, one next weekend. They cranking up. And let's talk about the Atlanta Braves, because they're what I want to talk about, and also the fantasy perspective surrounding the Atlanta Braves. And let's start with the Braves' number one prospect, because you start with number one, because it's the first integer on the positive side. And I'm talking, of course, about the young man out of Colombia, Julio Teheran. And he is proving why we did not trade him. He's proving why Martin Prado and Randall Delgado were the gentlemen who went to Arizona in exchange for Mr. Upton. He's proving why the Braves have stuck with him, even after last season's struggles, and he's proving why he deserves to be in the rotation. He has dominated so far in the Grapefruit League. I know it's just spring training, but it's still great to see. And he's got a 1.35 ERA, leading the Grapefruit League in strikeouts with 20, and, you know, really hitting the plate. And according to Dave O'Brien, AJC beat writer for the Braves, it's due to a little bit of a shift in repertoire, Carson. And apparently he's throwing the sinker more and also has been mixing in more breaking balls to go with his traditional four-seamer and changeup mix. So a four-pitch mix seems like it might be a little too much for a young guy, but clearly it's working for Mr. Tehran.
Yeah, and like you said, for a young guy, so I guess it's better now than later. You know, working other pitches into his repertoire and sort of figuring out what works for him now that he's at a younger, meldable age. But, I mean, the numbers in spring training are great, and like you said, it's spring training, but definitely a positive, you know, seeing is that he's going to be asked to take on a much larger role in the rotation this year.
Yeah, certainly, and apparently the increased use of the sinker, the significance of that, obviously, is less going for strikeouts, more pitching to contact. And Tehran is a guy who's always been able to get the strikeout. He's always been able to generate the swing and miss. He's had high velocity during his career. However, the Braves have wanted him to make some slight adjustments in his delivery, which resulted in a little bit less velocity. And the Braves were okay with that because they want to preserve his health long-term. So they made the delivery a little less violent. There's a little less torque going on his arm. But overall, he's more effective because the two-seamer is very different than a four-seamer. They're both fastballs, but they could not be more different pitches. One moves up and away. One moves down and in to righties. And if you mix them well, and if hitters don't know when which one is coming, that can generate a lot of weak swings, a lot of jams, a lot of ground balls. And that's what he's been doing. And he's been pitching more efficiently. He pitched down in the Dominican Winter League. We were talking about that earlier. And so, you know, that's a reason probably why he's having success right now. But it sounds like he's just locating his pitchers and he's got confidence, which is what's important. I remember 2 years ago, he was the AAA pitcher of the year. And he had about a 2 ERA. And I think he went like 12-3 over the course of the whole season in the minor leagues, in AAA. That was his first year in AAA, and he was several years younger than most players in the league. So he's not far removed from that. Like I said, 2 years ago. So the ceiling is very high on this young man. The Braves are definitely happy that they kept him. Like I said, he's just reinforcing their belief in him. And right now, barring an unforeseen, you know, just weird consequence, he'll be the fifth starter, which is exciting to me and to the lay person, to the lay fantasy player, should be exciting to you as a late round draft pick or not so late round draft pick if you're in some sort of dynasty situation. Because a guy who's cemented into the rotation at the beginning of the year, assuming he doesn't blow things too bad, is going to get things done. And like the Braves' infield defense isn't great, but he's going to have a lot of runs to play with. And it helps to be the fifth starter because you're generally going against five starters and those games are easier to win. And if Tehran can carry this over into the regular season, we should all be very excited about what he can bring to the table as just the next in a bevy of young, talented Braves starting pitchers.
Definitely, Ace. And you know, that's exciting for fantasy and real baseball alike. And are you targeting you know, Tehran as we go in our long walk to freedom, long walk for Freeman draft coming up pretty soon?
Certainly not. I think he's a horrible draft pick in that league, but in every other league I would go for him. I would never endorse taking it. No, you know, I am not, only because I know as a Braves homer league, someone inevitably is going to jump higher for him than I'm willing to go. But it is tempting. It's definitely tempting because he's a guy who would be a fun keep at a 13th round, 14th or 15th, however the vote goes. So I would definitely target him, guys, and no reason not to take a look at young Mr. Tehran, even if you're in a redraft league, because, you know, with Beachy coming back in the middle of the season, you know, it does make you think, hey, is someone's job going to be threatened in the Braves rotation? And maybe, but, you know, only if they're struggling. Nobody's going to get taken out of the rotation if they're having a successful fantasy season for you. And we need Tehran. We need him to be solid because it's not a rotation with star power. It's a rotation that's more about depth than being well-rounded. And I think he can provide some stability at the back end. Last year, the rotation was just really good all year round, even though there were some holes. but hopefully we can kind of shore up the holes. And then, you know, it's a situation where I could very well see them kind of trading off between who's kind of carrying the team at the time. Maybe Medlin has another torrid stretch. Maybe Miner catches fire a little bit like he did last year. You know, maybe Teron starts really good out of the gate because he's not as well known, as well scouted, and, you know, can carry over the confidence of this stellar spring.
Definitely. It's all, you know, very viable situations, and, you know, it might be that that's the way that, you know, how things have to play out with a rotation that is getting younger and is sort of turning a page. So definitely very interesting insight for an exciting season for the Braves, and especially our young rotation.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. And just to mention the Yankees, because piling on is something that I'll do. I don't give a F. And piling on in the Yankees case means, honestly, I'm sympathizing at this point. I'm not even going to say this in a derisive voice. Now it sounds like Derek Jeter might not start the season on the team.
Wow.
Which means that there, I giggled without meaning to. I tried not to. I tried not to, AJ, but I'm sorry. I mean, Cano, who is a hell of a player, but Cano is going to be the only, I think he's the only holdover from last year's team that's going to be in the opening day lineup. Is that?
That's crazy.
Maybe Cervelli, if he counts, but the only, I mean, it's just mind-boggling. And they're going to need Brett Gardner to come back and provide a spark at the top. They're going to need more than anything. They're going to need their team doctors to find some magic potions and get to work on something extraordinary. But, you know, it's the crows coming home to roost. The crows, this decrepit old crows sagged down by bags of money. And, you know, they bought themselves this team, and they knew what was going to happen, and they just didn't stay with the times. And I guess it was really the new collective bargaining agreement, because there were not much stricter, but slightly stricter penalties laid on teams who go over the luxury tax. And it was just enough, combined with, you know, just a slightly inherent, not inherent, but a new frugality of the next generation of Steinbrenner, where the previous generation had no such qualms about drop bags. But, you know, the Yankees, the measures they took were pretty drastic. All in all, they weren't able to restock their farm system very much. It still has some promise, some decent position players, but there's no help for the rotation right now, and we haven't even gotten to them. You know, we're talking about all the position players being hurt, and they're just filling these holes with aging veterans and some guys that might come up. But, you know, I think with the new rules of the collective bargaining agreement, you start losing draft picks if you're a certain amount over the luxury tax. So that was enough to scare them off, and it's a mess now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you say something's too big to fail, and it ultimately does, and, you know, with Tex being hurt and Granderson with his issues, I mean, like you said, you know, Cano might have to carry a big load, you know, as they move into the next season in an increasingly competitive AL East.
No doubt. Well, I appreciate you putting up with my ranting. I'm going to just bring up some exciting news that just popped up on my Twitter before we sign off. And once again, this has been Foul Territory on Blog Talk Radio, sponsored by BackSportsPage.com and SidelinesApp.com. But I just had a tweet from Omarion at One Omarion. Wale announces new album titled The Gifted, dropping June 25th. So get excited, Carson. Get excited,
yep.
World.
I actually, you brought that. I saw that today, and there's some video that goes along with it that I forgot to check out that I need to do as soon as possible, because I'm sure it will be epic.
Well, I just retweeted it, and it has the Vimeo link. So
nice.
Just hop on that Twitter, hopscotch on the internet, and you will find it. right away. Well, it's been real, my friend. Thanks for joining me to talk some football, baseball, and college basketball. Happy tournament eve to everybody. Thanks so much for listening. It's been Ace Beal and Carson Day Phillips Spots on Foul Territory.
Peace.
Soldier Boy, so. Hey, I got the new dance for y'all called the Soldier Boy. We got a punch, then crank back three times from left to right.
Why me crank it, why me roll? Why me crank that?